Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, can Islam and science coexist? Back in the 9th, 10th, and 11th centuries, Islamic culture was the center of the scientific world. Muslim scholars in Baghdad, Cairo, and Cordoba made groundbreaking discoveries in science and mathematics. But today, most observers say science in Muslim countries is in a terrible state.
You're talking about roughly one-fifth, perhaps, of the world population, roughly 1.2 billion people out of 6 billion. These 20% of the people produce nowadays slightly more than 1% of the intellectual production of the world. This is heartbreaking.
Today, we'll talk about the special challenges facing Muslim scientists. And we'll travel to Istanbul to meet the world's most famous Islamic creationist, Harun Yahya. Also, the story of the first Muslim woman in space.
It was absolutely wonderful. The experience of being able to see Earth from space, it was just breathtaking.
We start this hour with Steve Paulson's roundup of scholars who track scientific developments in the Muslim world. Steve turned first to Taner Edis, a Turkish-American physicist at Truman State University, whose books include An Illusion of Harmony, Science and Religion in Islam.
How would you assess the state of scientific knowledge in the Islamic world?
Dismal. Right now, the situation is such that if you made all Muslim scientists working in basic science to vanish from the face of the earth, the rest of the scientific community would barely notice. There's very little contribution coming in from Muslim lands right now.
But Islamic countries seem to be very open to using modern technology. But you're distinguishing that from original scientific research.
Yeah, it's pretty important to distinguish between basic science, what you might do in, say, physics or biology, and applied science, more technology-oriented work.
How big a problem is that? I mean, I suppose you could just say that, you know, take the science that's done in the West and apply it to these cultures. But is the problem deeper than that? I mean, does it really create larger problems?
Well, falling further behind in, say, something like condensed matter physics means that you're going to have a harder time adapting technologies that are going to be based on this new knowledge of physics. What's going to happen is that means you're excluding Muslims from the creation of new technologies. So what this does, it permanently locks in the Muslim world to a subordinate position in those aspects of modern life that depend on creativity in technology and science. And this is a huge swath of modern life. If you're a Muslim and you're worried about, say, the military weakness of Muslim countries so that Western imperialist powers can do anything they like, well, you're going to have to see that today's warfare depends a lot on high-tech accomplishments. If you're worried about the Muslim world falling behind economically, that, again, you're under the thumb of economically advanced Western imperial powers because of that, well, the modern economy depends a lot on technology and science as well. This is not something that's controversial in the Muslim world. Even the strongest Islamist will acknowledge that Muslims have some work to do over here.
But what's so striking about all of this, about what you're saying now about the state of science in the Islamic world, is that at one time, I guess especially from the 9th through the 12th centuries, Islam was arguably the center of the scientific world.
Oh, very much so. I mean, if you're talking about preserving and further developing the legacy of proto-scientific thought that was inherited from the Greeks and Romans, all of the action was taking place in the Islamic world. Western Europe at the time was a land of barbarians, totally intellectually negligible. Muslims developed some very interesting ideas over those centuries, but it is something of a mistake to think of this as analogous to modern science, what Muslims were doing back then. It was still a medieval, pre-scientific intellectual enterprise, and they never quite made the breakthrough, the scientific revolution that took place in Europe. Today, in fact, is something of an impediment for the Muslim world doing science to continually look back to the glories of the past and keep saying, hey, the Islamic world used to be a world leader in science, but it is not anymore. Because looking backwards like this tends to obscure some very important differences between modern science and medieval thinking of all sorts.
Give me an example of that. I mean, where does this actually create problems, trying to tap into this supposed ancient glory of Islamic science?
One of the features of medieval Islamic science that some modern Muslim thinkers want to revive is the way of perceiving reality, perceiving the universe, as very much a spiritual, God-centered place, which tends to work against the independence of science from religious concerns and religious institutions. One of the things that in the Western world has helped science make the breakthrough is precisely achieving this independence, this autonomy of science. In the Muslim world, this still is a relatively controversial concept. Just going back and uncritically trying to revive medieval perceptions of reality is not going to be very helpful.
Taner Edis is a physicist at Truman State University. His books include An Illusion of Harmony, Science and Religion in Islam. Ziadin Sardar agrees science in the Muslim world is a travesty, but he disagrees with Taner Edis on other matters. For instance, he says the Golden Age of Islam did far more than transmit Greek knowledge. He says Muslim scientists made groundbreaking discoveries in various fields, from optics and astronomy to algebra. And what's needed now, he believes, is what he calls an Islamic science. Steve Paulson talked with Ziadin Sardar.
You have made the controversial claim that Muslims need an Islamic science. What makes you say that?
I think it is only controversial if you think that science has no values. By Islamic science, I mean science that is infused with the ethics and, if you like, morality and values of Islam. Now, if you say that science has no values whatsoever, then this is a controversial statement. But science does have values. The values of science come from a number of different directions. For example, the most obvious direction is funding. Governments fund the kind of research that they want, and their funding reflects their priorities, their emphasis. In other words, it reflects their values.
It certainly reflects what they will end up studying, because funding will be funneled into certain directions. But what about the scientific process itself? I mean, I think if you were to ask most scientists about the work they do, they would say that science is science. It cuts across all geographical and religious boundaries. It's a neutral, value-free methodology.
Well, I think that claim is partially correct. I do believe that the science that is done in a laboratory is pretty objective. But there's a lot that happens before you get to the laboratory. I mean, why should we study certain questions and not certain other questions? Why, for example, should we pursue, say, research on cancer or AIDS, but not research on, say, diarrhea? So essentially what I'm saying is that, yes, science is objective. The results of science have to be applicable across all cultures, and they have to be repeatable, you know, in all time and space. But at the end of the day, science is a human activity.
You have written, and I'm quoting here, Western science is inherently destructive and cannot fulfill the needs of Muslim societies. I understand what you've just been saying.
That's a pretty strong statement, yes.
A very strong statement.
I like to do that. You see, because that made you sit up and listen. Let us look at some of the recent developments. I mean, genetic research, you know, there's serious concerns. at the end of the day, what we are doing is essentially redefining what it means to be human. If you are going to start playing with the genetic makeup of human beings and start inserting genes, taking genes out, creating designer babies, not creating designer babies, whatever. At the end of the day, what we are actually doing is redefining what it means to be human. And that's exactly my point about science and values. Before we undertake that research, we need to discuss these values. I am passionate about science. My first degree is in physics. My postgraduate PhD work in information science. In the early days of my career, I was a science writer. Most of my early scholarly work is on the history of Islamic science. I'm passionate about science. And the question for me was, why is that, that a society that was passionate about science in the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th century seems to have absolutely no appreciation or love of science today? And after thinking about it and traveling around the Muslim world and talking to people, I came to the conclusion that basically contemporary Muslim societies did not see science as it exists today as having any direct bearing to them. And I thought the only way to do that is to bring the Islam into equation, to say, look, your values can be reflected in science.
But what's so interesting about what you're saying is that most outsiders, and for instance, historians of science, who try to understand why there's been this decline in science in Muslim countries, would point to just the opposite reason, that there was too much Islamic thinking, that that religious orthodoxies took over, and a certain conservative, overly religious brand of Islam discouraged the spirit of free inquiry and actually required scientific research to fit religious beliefs. I mean, I think the criticism there is that Muslim scientists couldn't separate themselves from religion.
I think this is slightly kind of reductive view. But even if we accept this view, this does not undermine the basic teachings of the Quran and the basic teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. You know, the Quran says, you know, go out and study nature. And it doesn't say that one place. It says that again and again. The Prophet said that the ink of the scholar is worth more than the blood of the martyr. The Prophet said, go and study. So knowledge and reason are at the center core of Islam. You cannot say that the teachings of Islam are against science. In fact, my argument is that you cannot have Islam without science.
Hmm. So does part of this project then require going back to the Quran and looking at what the Quran says about
science?
That's
precisely what it does not require. And unfortunately, that is what has happened. Most Muslims, unfortunately, and some of these are university academics and thinkers, when they think of Islam, they immediately think of Quran, and they think that Islamic science is finding science in the Quran. Quran is not a book of science. It's a book of guidance. Its revelation is not about science. The question is, can science come back to Islam?
What would it take to do that?
What it would take is a profound conceptual shift. I mean, if it was simply a question of money, for example, then Saudi Arabia has a hell of a lot of money and they bought all the science in the world, yet nobody would describe them as remotely a scientific culture. It's not a question of just money. It's not just a question of, you know, government supporting research. The Muslims need to rethink Islam itself. The concepts like ijtihad, sustained reasoning, the concept of what is ilm or what is knowledge, so that science then comes back to the center of Islam. I think it has to be. Knowledge, understanding, they have to be at the core of any Muslim society. And so I don't see contemporary Muslim societies as really Muslim societies. I mean, they are societies consisting of Muslims, but they are not coherent Muslim society.
Ziauddin Sardar is a London-based scholar and cultural critic. His memoir is called Desperately Seeking Paradise, Journeys of a Skeptical Muslim. Nidal Gassoum is an Algerian-born astrophysicist who teaches at American University in the United Arab Emirates. Like Sardar, he looks back to the golden age of Islam with great pride and points to some of the early Muslim scientists and philosophers as personal heroes. Today, he says science in the Islamic world is abysmal. Steve Paulson wanted to know what happened.
Some people will point to the fact that most of the Muslim world was under colonial rule for a long time until about 40, 50 years ago. The rate of literacy in most of these countries during the colonial period was less than 10%. 10% of people who could even read or write. So how can you expect anybody to do any science or to produce any books? But this is, I certainly do not regard this as the prime factor, because 99% of the Muslim world has been out of colonial rule for about half a century now. So, okay, we can blame colonialism only so much. I think if we can summarize it into one issue, it is the freedom of inquiry. It is letting the people go free It is allowing them to just go and investigate and explore and debate and exchange views. It is not a coincidence that democracy and freedom are equally dismal in the Muslim
world.
So
you see this as mainly a political issue rather than a religious issue?
The religious factor also plays a role, and I can tell you how in a moment. But it is not only, or perhaps not even mainly, because of the religious factors that most of the Muslim world is in such a sorry state. The religious dimensions of society tend to be overly conservative, tend to be overly subduing, crushing, stifling of inquiry, thoughts, etc. We have had too many people who were declared heretic. You may know, for example, the case of Nasser Hamid Abu Zayd, who in Cairo had written some books and was up for promotion at the university. And then the committee that was looking at the books said, oh, wait a minute, this is heretical, we can't allow this. And then somebody took him to court, and the court declared him to be a heretic. It was like, okay, now your wife is automatically divorced from you because she's not allowed to be married to a non-Muslim, and now anybody can kill you because under, you know, law of apostasy.
What did he write that was considered so offensive?
His analysis of the Quran, he's a linguist, really, an expert at philosophy and language, and sort of he was analyzing the Quran from a certain perspective, and he said, okay, this means that there is some evolution of the meanings of the Quran, or this points to some human element in the writing of the Quran or the compilation of the Quran or whatever. And people said, you can't even touch that. You can't even go in that direction.
Well, let me follow up on that, because that raises a huge question, which is how to read the Quran, because it seems that the Quran does not exactly have the same status as, say, the Bible does in Christian culture. I mean, the Quran is seen as literally the Word of God.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, in Christianity, there are some people who say the Bible is the Word of God, etc. But by and large, most people understand that the scriptures in the other religions were written by humans, maybe by some inspiration or whatever. But in Islam, everybody is required to believe that every word from the Quran was revealed as is written by God. So there was no rewriting, there was no inspiration. It wasn't this is the way Muhammad understood it and told it to his people. No, it is letter to the letter, word by word, the revelation of God.
Well, it makes it pretty hard to read the Quran metaphorically, doesn't it, rather than literally?
Some people argue that way. But some other people, including myself, argue the exact opposite. If you believe, as every single Muslim believes, that the Quran was not revealed for a specific people at a specific place at a certain time, it was revealed for humanity at large, for people at all times, as a book of guidance, not a book of specific prescriptions and specific content, specific knowledge. And if that is the case, then there is no way that the Quran can be understood literally and still be applicable to many, many people in many different places in many different centuries.
If you don't mind, let me get a little more personal here. Mm-hmm. Do you consider yourself an observant Muslim?
Yes, to the largest extent, yes.
So you read the Quran regularly?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Not regularly, but I've read it many times.
Do you pray?
Yes,
five times a day?
Yes, I pray regularly, yes.
You are a man of science. You're extremely well-versed in all kinds of scientific matters and history. What about this whole business of the Quran as being literally the revealed word of God? I mean, did humans write it? What do you make of that?
Yes, the whole idea of revelation is a complex issue. What does it mean that a book or some scripture was revealed? 99% of Muslims, if not 99.99% of Muslims, will say, well, the angel came, Gabriel dictated some sentences to Muhammad, and then he recited them to people, and that's revelation. To me, this is not an acceptable description. And to deeper thinkers, they will say, no, revelation was probably some kind of an inspiration. Muhammad had reached a certain spiritual level. And if you read the biography of Muhammad, you will find that before he started receiving revelation, he had spent many years going sometimes for days and nights into seclusion in a cave outside of Mecca for extended periods of time, where clearly he was having a spiritual awakening. And so at some point, there was some revelation, small r. Now, How did that happen? What happened? His spirit opened up. There was some connection to the other dimension of reality that we cannot touch and describe scientifically. Something happened that he started to perceive certain truths or certain ideas or certain views, certain morals, and he put them into sentences. Now, it is up to the believer to decide this putting into sentences of the spiritual experience that he was having, whether that was directed from on high and he had no choice but to just basically write down what he was being dictated to write, or whether there was some participatory element in this experience. This is the definition of being religious, right?
Nidal Gassum is an astrophysicist at American University in the United Arab Emirates. You can read a transcript of Steve Paulson's full interview with Gassum on our website at ttbook.org/scienceandmeaning. Up next, the story of the first Muslim woman in space. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Can Islam and Science Coexist?, is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, is supported by grants from the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and by the Neuer Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
Anusha Ansari always dreamed of traveling into space.
It started when I was very young in Iran, and I basically fell in love with the stars. I used to sleep outside on my grandparents' balcony at nights, just looking at the night skies and seeing all those wonderful shining stars made me want to be closer to them. I looked at the stars and I felt the answers to life's most important questions are out there.
Years later, Anusha Ansari fulfilled her dream, became the first Muslim woman to venture into space. But it wasn't easy. Her family left Iran shortly after the revolution in 1979 and moved to America. Eventually, she married and, with her husband, built up a telecommunications company, which they ended up selling for more than $500 million. The money gave Ansari the chance to chase her lifelong ambition, a trip into space, on board the International Space Station. Ansari writes about her journey in the book My Dream of Stars. Her first step was to train with a group of Russian cosmonauts.
So the training is about 6 months full-time, pretty much in Star City, which is a military base close to Moscow, and that's where all the cosmonauts and astronauts train. You have to pre-qualify for the training.
You have to prove that you're physically able to withstand it, I suppose.
Yes. The Russians were actually not very especially happy to have a woman in the program. So they tried hard to discourage me, disqualify me, but I was determined that I'm not going home. So I stayed and I pushed through it.
They tried all sorts of things, I gather, including the centrifuge that sends you around and around. You spin until you're just about ready to pass out.
Yes, the centrifuge actually was one of the pre-qualification tests. And usually what they do is they do a run, they go up to 4 Gs, which is 4 times the force of gravity. And before they started the test, they said they decided to ramp it up to 9 Gs. And I was scared, but I didn't let, you know, my fear to show. And I said, okay, fine, let's go, let's do it. So I went through it and it was the difficult test. But fortunately, I actually made it through with flying colors and surprised and raised some eyebrows there. So it helped me actually to get through the program.
You were unusual in this program, not only a woman, and they hadn't been prepared to cope with that, but also you wanted to sew the flag of Iran on your spacesuit, and I gather that was not something that they were very happy about either.
Yes, someone wrote an article and mentioned the fact that I was wearing the flag on my training suit. And right after that, I was told that I have to remove the flag. And I'm like, why is that? I mean, this is not something controversial. I wasn't advertising anything, and I was just wearing the colors of the flag.
But this was clearly important to you. You wanted to have those colors on your suit.
It absolutely was important because I wanted to make sure that I showed that I came from Iran, and I wanted to show the world a different image of Iranians because I was tired of seeing what's shown on TV all the time and what people perceive as an Iranian woman. And also, by that time, the word had gotten out about me being part of the space flight, and millions of Iranians all over the world were so excited and so happy, and they're watching and they're following me. And I thought I was bringing a message that, you know, I'm an Iranian who lives in America and I have made peace with both of these countries that are part of my life, and I was able to take the positives from both cultures and both countries.
But you were a practicing Muslim. The revolution, did it have an effect on your beliefs?
I should say that it didn't necessarily have an impact on my true belief in the spiritual nature of our universe. It had an impact on some of the practices, on some of the things I saw, and how sometimes religion is used to manipulate people in doing things that are not necessarily the teachings of that specific religion.
You were drawing a lot of attention from both Iranians at home in Iran, but also around the world. Did your trip draw a lot of attention in the rest of the Muslim world?
It did, especially women, Muslim women were very excited and happy. It was sort of not only a positive image for women in Iran, but also positive image of Muslim women all over the world.
We've talked about all of the work that you put into making it possible to be a part of this trip, but not about the trip itself. You spent, what was it, 11 days in space, and that was 2006. What was it like?
It was absolutely wonderful, just best experience I've ever had in my life. It was just amazing, the experience of being able to see Earth from space. It was just breathtaking and an image that has stayed with me and will stay with me forever. And it changes the way you see your life and basically you see the universe and your role in it.
In spiritual terms, clearly it was enormously valuable to you, but there is another part of it. I mean, it wasn't all easy, was it? You were sick the first day you were up in space. I guess that's not at all uncommon.
Yes, the body goes through a lot of changes being in the microgravity of space. So the first 2 days, my body was going through this adjustment. So I had the first thing that most people suffer from is difficulties with their vestibular system that causes nausea. So I forgot all my training and I was so excited in the capsule the first day that I kept flying all over the place and flipping around, and that did it. And I got very sick and had to take some medication for that, which made me drowsy. But then also you get headache because the fluid in your body shifts up to your head and puts a lot of pressure on your sinuses. And also because your spine starts stretching, you actually become taller in space, which is great because I'm a short person, but also it puts a lot of strain on your lower back, so you get lower back pain.
Was this the hardest part of the trip?
Not really. I would say the hardest part was the landing. You know, the Soyuz capsule is pretty much like the Apollo capsules, but it's smaller. And instead of landing in water, it lands on the ground. So the impact at landing is pretty hard, and it really shakes you up. It feels like being in a car crash. So I would say that part probably was the hardest.
What was the most memorable part of the trip for you?
I would say seeing Earth for the first time, because it was very emotional for me. And up to that point, I didn't believe or realize that this all was happening and I am in space. But once I saw Earth from space, And I was able to feel sort of the warmth and the energy of it. It's when it clicked that I'm actually here, I'm in space, and I have realized my dream and something that I talked about it all my life. It was happening to me, and it was a very, very special moment.
Anousheh Ansari is the author of the memoir, My Dream of Stars, From Daughter of Iran to Space Pioneer. Once you start digging into questions about science and Islam, you'll soon run across the name of Harun Yahya, the leading creationist in the Muslim world. Now, I should mention that Yahya gets some seriously bad press in the West. He's a shadowy figure who was sentenced to 3 years in jail for extortion and running a crime gang, a conviction he's now appealing. So it may be tempting to dismiss him as a crackpot. But Yahya runs a sophisticated media empire that distributes books, videos, and websites around the Islamic world. Put it simply, his network has considerable influence. Steve Paulson traveled to Turkey to meet with Harun Yahya and some of his critics, and has this report.
You might think creationism is a distinctly American phenomenon, but creationist beliefs are also widespread throughout the Muslim world, and no one has done more to spread the anti-evolution gospel than Harun Yahya.
So right now, Harun Yahya is a global phenomenon in the Islamic world. You find Harun Yahya books in Islamic bookstores in London. You find Harun Yahya conference series in Indonesia. You find Harun Yahya books showing up as textbooks in Pakistani schools.
That's Tanner Edis, a Turkish-American physicist at Truman State University in Missouri. He says Harun Yahya's group, what's called the Science Research Foundation, has the kind of money and influence that American creationists can only dream of.
Harun Yahya has been able to sort of saturate Turkish media at certain times with a kind of a creationist message, and this is something that American creationists would very much like to do, but they just can't.
A few years ago, Harun Yahya made a splash with a glossy 13-pound, 800-page book called Atlas of Creation. His group mailed the book to at least 10,000 scientists, museums, and research centers in Europe and across the United States.
They must be 14 inches tall. I mean, it's just this huge, huge format, and it's about 4 inches thick and glossy paper, and it's sort of a velvet cover. I mean, there must be tons of money going into printing this thing.
Eugenie Scott works at the National Center for Science Education, which tracks creationist groups.
And it's expensive to ship. One of the professors who received a copy is a friend of mine. Checked back on the bill of lading and found the shipping company, and, you know, it cost like $11 just to ship this thing.
Just where he gets his money is one of the many mysteries that surrounds Harun Yahya. No one knows, though speculation runs from Saudi donors to wealthy Turks whose children have joined his secretive network. Harun Yahya lives in Istanbul, the sprawling metropolis that stands at the crossroads between Europe and Asia. Before I interviewed him, I talked with some well-connected journalists, academics, and businessmen, members of the secular elite, to get their impressions of this man. Harun Yahya is actually the pen name for Adnan Oktar, and it's clear he has both powerful friends and enemies. I asked the editor-in-chief of CNN Turk, Ferhat Boratov, what he thinks of Harun Yahya.
He is a very shadowy figure. We don't know much about his life. We don't know much about where this money comes from. And we will probably not know more about him in the foreseeable future.
Ishak Alatan is a prominent businessman who runs the Alarko Holdings Company in Istanbul. He describes Harun Yahya as a man who preys on the weaknesses of other people.
A man who has found a way of manipulating simple people. He's just a fake, a charlatan, a man who I wouldn't even consider dangerous because he has no impact.
That relatively benign view of Harun Yahya's influence is not shared by some of his other critics, like Soli Ozel, a professor of international relations at Istanbul University. He says Yahya's group functions like a cult.
He's really bad news. His organization entraps men and women. I've had a student who's been entrapped by them, and it's very difficult to get out.
How so? What do they do?
you get implicated in many things and you really cannot leave. They may be putting pressure on you, on your family. I mean, this student of mine, when she took her exams, there would be the two guys, you know, standing guard, so she wouldn't speak to anyone and all that. So obviously these are not methods that I can approve or like.
No matter what people think of Harun Yahya, it's clear that Islamic creationism has exploded in Turkey. Just why is a complicated story that may have as much to do with politics as religion. Unlike many Muslim countries, which simply ignore the science of life's origins, Turkey's high schools have taught evolution for decades, the legacy of Atatürk's campaign to secularize Turkey's public culture. Now, creationists are striking back at the country's secular power brokers. The Quran doesn't have a detailed origin story like the 6 days of creation found in Genesis, but it does say Adam was created out of clay in a heavenly paradise and later banished to earth. Many Turkish critics of evolution, including Harun Yahya, don't actually have a problem with the universe being nearly 14 billion years old, but they can't stomach the idea that humans descended from apes. And some government officials in the AKP, the ruling Islamic party, openly criticize evolution. In Ankara, I talked with the government's point man on religious issues, Mehmet Görmez.
Yani inanç konusu yaratılışla başlayan bir konudur.
In fact, the belief starts with the creation.
Eğer siz inançlı Allah'a inanıyorsanız,
if you believe in God,
öncelikle Allah'ın sizi yarattığına inanacaksınız.
You have to first believe that God created you.
Bütün dini metinler, bütün ilahi metinlerde insanın yaratıcı tarafından, Allah tarafından yaratıldığını söyler.
All the holy texts says that human beings are created by a holy force, God.
Ben evrim teorisinin de bilimsel bir konu değil, ideolojik bir konu olduğunu düşünüyorum.
I think that evolution theory is not a scientific one, but an ideologic one.
Back in Istanbul, I had no idea what to expect from my interview with Harun Yahya. Late one night, I was driven to an ultra-chic modern house on the Asian side of the city. Glass doors led out to a swimming pool, and a huge flat-screen TV hung over the living room. The biggest surprise was to find that I'd walked onto a stage set. Klieg lights beamed down on our interview chairs, and several men were there to operate the three video cameras. It turned out I wasn't the only one taping this interview. Harun Yahya is a burly man in his mid-50s. He has slicked back hair and a carefully trimmed beard, and wore his trademark white suit with a black t-shirt. He was gracious throughout our interview, though many of his comments surprised me, to say the least. I asked, how could so many evolutionary biologists be wrong?
Dünyada masonların yönetiminde bir Darwinist diktatörlük kuruldu, bilimsel bir diktatörlük kuruldu.
Well, we need to talk about Mason's role here, because Mason's managed the world through a scientific dictatorship. When you look at universities today, many academicians are forced to believe in Darwinism, because if they do not believe in Darwinism, they are just sent out of the academies or universities, and no one shows them respect.
I think it would surprise a lot of scientists in America to hear that they are being controlled, if that's the right word, by Masons. What makes you say that Masons have so much influence on scientific discussion?
Today, when you look at the rectors, deans, professors, scientific men, doctors, and even people working in police departments, many of them are Masons and members of some Masonic lodges, and their essential characteristic is that they act secretly and they are invisible.
I asked Harun Yahya about his legal troubles. A few years ago, he was convicted of extortion and running a criminal gang, a conviction he's now appealing. Some years back, he'd also been charged with drug possession and sexual assault, but both cases against him fizzled. Yahya told me that none of these charges has been proven, and that he and his friends had actually faced death threats.
If you were in that situation, and if you were given electricity, or if you were tortured, you would also sign the documents which were put in front of you, and this is what we did. We had no other chance because we would be dead otherwise, so we had to sign the statements.
Harun Yahya said he's faced many assassination attempts, and he told a story about how he was once framed by a policeman who'd slipped cocaine into his kebab. So why, I asked him, has he been targeted? He said it's because he's fighting against Darwinism, communism, and other terrorist organizations.
Are you saying Darwinism is a terrorist organization?
Darwinism, terörü...
Well, Darwinism can be defined as a kind of system which develops and nurtures terrorism all throughout the world. We can liken that to the development of mosquitoes in mud or in other ponds. So many fascist and communist leaders all around the world stated very clearly that they have been affected by the teachings and ideals of Darwinism.
I confess, it's hard to know what to make of this kind of anti-Darwinist rant, or even to understand how Harun Yahya has managed to spread his anti-evolution message to so many corners of the Muslim world. There was one more thing I wanted to do before I left Istanbul, to find out what the next generation of Turks thinks about evolution. So I went to Sabancı University and talked with some of the students there. It was only a small sampling, but I came away thinking that many of these students really are determined to learn about science and evolution.
I am interested in evolution.
Yeah, I know it contradicts with religion, but I mean, for me, religion is something else.
As a new PhD student, I would say it is at least good to have several explanations how people evolved. For example, the holy book says is also another possibility. I would not be too harsh on any of them.
In Turkey, 99% of people are Muslims. I think that's the reason why a majority doesn't believe in evolution and Darwinism.
So you think you kind of have to choose between science or religion?
The majority of people believe so. I don't believe that way.
People just don't want to look at apes and say, you know, we have descended from those, that's gross, you know. It's striking that whether Muslim or Christian, all conservatives, when it comes to their points of view regarding the evolution, they all say, okay, it's not possible. There's this consensus that I find really amazing.
Steve Paulson prepared that report on Harun Yahya. Steve traveled to Turkey as part of the International Reporting Project's Gatekeepers trip, which is supported by Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Coming up, the profound insights of the Sufi mystic Rumi. For to the best of our knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Can Islam and Science Coexist? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, is supported by grants from the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and by the Noor Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
It's easy to get caught up in debates about the Muslim world, especially questions about religious doctrine. So it may be refreshing to look back at one of the world's great mystics, the Sufi poet Rumi. Rumi lived in the 13th century on the eastern edge of the Persian Empire, eventually settling in what is now Turkey. And he left a remarkable cache of poetry and spiritual wisdom. Today, Rumi is, quite remarkably, one of America's best-selling poets, thanks largely to his longtime translator, Coleman Barks. And Strange Champs talked with Barks about the insights of Rumi.
You've spent so much time with this poetry, becoming the bridge, bringing Rumi back to us here in the 21st century. What's your sense of what it's like to be inside a Rumi poem?
Well, it feels like I've been released from a cage into the air, kind of sense of freedom. There are many metaphors for that kind of spaciousness. An ocean with no shore.
Maybe you should read something.
Let's see. Okay. I am so small, I can barely be seen. How can this great love be inside me? Look at your eyes. They're small, but they see enormous things. So often he'll do that. He'll ask a question, how can this great love be inside me? And then he'll give an image that is an answer. It's the way the eye contains the night sky. In that same way, the great love can be inside a small human being.
You know, Rumi is he's the great poet of the Sufi tradition, and maybe we could talk a little bit about what that means. Some people I know describe Sufism as the inner mystical side of Islam.
Uh-huh.
What did it mean in Rumi's day to be an Islamic mystic, a Sufi?
Well, I have a different sort of take on that. I just think it's the way of the heart. He keeps saying it's beyond religion, so it's beyond what we usually think of as Christianity or Islam or Judaism, all those isms. It's beyond ism. That sort of frees it up. I think that's what makes him so available.
It's striking that Rumi kind of doesn't really fit within the doctrines of any particular religious tradition, or one who would maybe want to explode all religious dogmas and doctrines.
Well, that's my take on him, yeah.
People like that, religious authorities tend not to like to own up to. So I guess I was wondering if Rumi had particular conflicts.
Well, not so much, because his personality evidently was so gentle and so inclusive that he just couldn't be attacked. He had such authority within his own gentleness. So he could say things that are wildly subversive. And for example, he said, if you think that it's important to call yourself a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or a Hindu or a Buddhist, if you think those are important ways of dividing up in the world, then you're making a division between your heart and how you act in the world. So it's such a wildly subversive thing to say, even now. And he was saying it in the 13th century when the Crusades were coming through his country, you know. It's amazing they didn't kill him. But they evidently had something about him, like St. Francis. You couldn't attack him.
The great teachers, the great mystics, I guess, speak to people beyond the bounds of their specific religions. But,
uh-huh.
You know, remind us who Rumi is or was. Was he raised in this mystical tradition, or is it, you know, was there a kind of blinding insight that came to him?
The central event in Rumi's life is his meeting with Shams Tabriz, this wild mystic that maybe we don't have anything comparable in the Western world to Shams. It may be like Thoreau to the 500th power, Dostoevsky to the 20th.
Wild-haired visionary?
Well, there was that part of him, and he was just a deeply lonely man. He wanted a companion who was on his own level. And a voice came to him once and said, your friend is Jalaluddin of Konya. And so he went to Konya and met Rumi. And they were together for, say, 3 years probably. And then Shams disappeared. The one story is that he was murdered by jealous disciples of Rumi. Another is that he left in order that Rumi would be compelled to move in a deeper direction.
Why would his leaving compel Rumi to grow deeper?
There's something about grief, isn't there, that takes us deeper. The poems come out of grief as well as a deep ecstatic joy of the interconnectedness of all things.
Rumi wrote about his grief about the loss of Shams.
Yeah.
He writes about searching for him, and he writes about feeling that he has moved beyond the search because he knows that he holds Shams in his heart.
Somehow he is the friendship. He moves beyond the pronouns.
Is there a poem that comes to mind that...
Yeah, the one that's I, you, he, she, we, you, they. in the garden of mystic lovers, these are not true distinctions. I, you, he, she, we, you, they. In the garden of mystic lovers, in that realm of consciousness that he's trying to take us into, the pronouns are not true distinctions. Mm. We interconnect in ways that language can't quite say.
Here in the West, we have this long tradition of separating two different kinds of knowing, the kind of knowing we do with our rational minds. That's part of the scientific method, mm-hmm. Enlightenment thinking. We tend to separate that from the intuitive, non-rational, mystical way of knowing. Would Rumi have made that distinction?
Maybe not. He's a kind of a scientist of consciousness. He tries to study experience. You know, he's really talking about the nature of love or the nature of friendship. His poems try to help us experience that. That's why the Sufis have no doctrine. All they have is what they've experienced. He says that the longing is for the longing itself. We didn't want to hear that, did we? The longing, you know, we're longing for something we already have. Longing. It's like redefining God. So what we thought we were longing for God, but now we already are that, and yet we long for it.
Do you have favorite quatrains in this section?
Let's see. As you start out on the way appears. As you cease to be, true life begins. As you grow smaller, the world cannot contain you. You will be shown a being that has no you inside it.
And he does that same motion of an image of something very, very tiny and compressed and contained, and then he explodes it into something that's,
As you cease to be, true life begins. All the great religious traditions try to say what that is, you know, how it is when the ego dissolves and you just have the rose light of the dawn coming up or something, you know. He keeps trying to find images for that.
Oh, read the next one. I love the next one with the image of the fish and the sea.
Dear mind, such a traveler, always moving, like a fish looking for the sea. That's the joke, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The fish is looking for the sea, while the great heart's ocean waits all around and inside it. How can you live outside this love?
That's beautiful.
Someone asked my teacher once, Bawa Muhyiddin, what it was like for him to be alive. And he said, it's like driving a car. You're inside and you're tending to things, but you're also the landscape you're driving through. And like the fish, the ocean is inside the fish, and the fish is looking for the sea.
Coleman Barks is America's best-known translator of Rumi. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps about his book, Rumi, The Big Red Book. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Can Islam and Science Coexist? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, 5 Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Original theme music for the series was written by Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions. For more information on this series and to find additional material about the topics we've explored, please go to our website at ttbook.org/scienceandmeaning. And special thanks to two of our sponsors for Science and the Search for Meaning, the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, and Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science.
PRI, Public Radio International.